Hi, my name's Russell Norman, and this is a podcast called Read Lots, Write Lots, a podcast for those who love to write. Today, we have a very exciting episode lined up. In our writing tips segment, Deidre will be talking about sentence construction. But firstly, we'll be talking to Laura Harishuka. Laura is a primary school teacher working in the rainy north of England, where she lives with her wonderful husband, amazing toddler, and her quite frankly mediocre cat. She got into writing during the COVID end of world in 2020 when she was on maternity leave. Readsy gave her a community of support and encouragement, as well as letting her flex her writing critique muscles. Essentially, she spent a good chunk of her maternity leave marking work, which should tell you how much she loves her job. She became a judge on Readsy to get more involved in the community and loves how much reading other people's work improves her own writing. In her spare time, if she gets any, she reads voraciously and bakes a lot. She writes under her maiden name, Laura Clark. Over to you, Deidre.
Thanks, Russell. Oh, Laura, I'm so glad you're here. Laura Clark, I've known you from Readsy for over a year. We've been writing together during this pandemic. Your married name, Harishuka, again, a lovely Polish name. I've been looking at your old writings, and I noticed some of your earliest stories that you started were about family and homecoming. So let's just start with Eliza. What's going on with year two of motherhood?
Yeah, doing pretty well with it. She has not died yet, which is always a positive. She continues to be perfect, which is nice. She started putting together sentences which are mostly bossy sentences, like "Mummy cut apple" and "Mummy come here."
It sounds like a young lady who knows what she wants. That's good.
Just get, pretty much so.
Get her feisty. That's the only way to get through this life in the 21st century. So, what are you reading to her? What books have you on shelves stacked to read to her? I'm sure you read her tons.
Oh, she's got so many books. I think she honestly has more books than I do. She loves anything that has a funny voice that the adults read to her in. There's a book called, This Book Has No Pictures. I think it's by BJ Novak. And it's amazing because it's all about the words of the book make you say it in a different way. And it's just a very funny book. She also likes a book called What Are You Doing With That Stick? Which is essentially just a character who has a stick who is pretending that it is something else. So the narrator says, "What are you doing with that stick?" And he goes, "What stick?" And it's a dragon fighting sword or, you know, whatever.
So all about creativity, just kind of, you know, seeing the world from different perspectives.
Yeah.
Right? Anything or a stick, basically.
Anything that she can stroke as well.
Perfect. Well, that's good. Is she mimicking reading? Does she kind of follow along with the words and all those great emergent literacy skills? So
not so much at the moment, because it's mostly, can I eat the book? Can I lick the book? Can I turn the pages by myself? But she did open Fox's Lost Socks the other day and went, "Oh, Fox Lost Socks." So she's obviously starting to pick up some of the words from it.
That's awesome. That's wonderful. Well, you're back at school. So how is, you teach the middle grades, correct?
Yeah, I teach 11-year-olds, which is the oldest year in our primary school system, but I think it's like fifth grade for you guys.
That's a great, great year, right before the puberty forest, you know, before they get lost and all the nonsense.
Yeah,
are they in the nonsense now?
It's the year where the puberty forest approaches, but it's my favorite year to teach. You get a little bit more banter with the children, you get a little bit more engagement from them, and you really start to see them come into their own as people, which is just amazing to watch.
Now, do you have some latitude to kind of teach them different writing styles and genres? Because not that we're bragging about the U.S. school system ever, but we pretty much teach our middle schoolers that there's two ways to write, argumentative and informative. And it kind of traumatizes me because I get seniors and I have them write some creative pieces and they're like, "Well, can I do this?" And I'm like, "Yeah, it's creative. Do it. Go ahead." And they want to be in this box, in this formula. For our very austere state standardized tests. And it kind of breaks my heart. I just kind of wished the teachers had more autonomy to have more creative writing from the younger ages. Do you get to have fun with that? Can they make stories about sticks?
They absolutely can. I'm teaching them a picture book in a couple of weeks' time about World War II. But I'm in charge of writing for my school.
So Wait, back up. You're doing a picture book for World War II? That's kind of grisly, right?
Essentially, it's the boy in striped pajamas, but in a more palatable way for 11-year-olds. But it starts to introduce some of the themes of it and starts to work on empathy and things like that. It's a good book. It's called Rose Blanche. But yeah, I'm in charge of writing for my school, so I kind of get to pick and choose the way that it works to some extent. Obviously, I have to stay within the curriculum and I have to consult with my colleagues, but I do get a certain amount of control over what is taught, and which means that I get to bring in some things that I really like. I taught my year five class Frankenstein last year because I liked the book and I thought that they should be exposed to texts that are a little bit more complicated. We're doing a Michael Morpurgo text at the moment called Kenzuki's Kingdom. And yeah, I think we're doing Sherlock Holmes in a couple of weeks' time. I tend to go for books and then teach through those. So we're doing, the instructions manual at the moment on how to stay alive on a desert island, which connects with the book that we're doing. We tend to do genres as a base and then go, okay, what's the purpose of this? What's the audience of this? And work from there so the children know that there are multiple purposes and get practice writing for lots of different audiences as well, which I think from the sounds of it gives them a little bit more creative freedom than the US system.
Yeah, it's a little tight right now. I really like what you were saying about learning the the socio-emotional skills through literature. I think I just finished reading an article about how compassion and empathy is taught best through fiction as opposed to some speech or instruction manual or what have you. I think we need to kind of get back towards more fiction. In the U.S., we've been kind of more towards nonfiction, and there's a lot of other exploratory emotions you can get in with reading some of this literature. So do you find that the writing skills are kind of hanging in there, or do you find them kind of diminished in this new kind of digital era?
I find that writing skills as a general rule are doing pretty well. I think COVID's had a massive impact on kids, not just my kids in my school, but my friends who teach in other schools have said exactly the same thing. And that is very much the basics that it's hitting. They're not necessarily losing their creativity and their ideas, but because they have been online for 18 months, that's gotten rid of the capital letters, the full stops, their comma splicing. They're doing all the things that make me twitch because they're the things that they should have ironed out when they're kind of 8, 9 years old. And they get to me 3 years later, but because they have only had to do Microsoft Word or whatever program they've been using and they get that wiggly red line, they haven't had to think about whether they're using there, or there, because the program will do that for them. And they haven't had to worry about where the sentence should end because the program does it for them. So the basic skills have definitely been lost over the last 18 months.
Yeah, I worry about what the quality of what they're reading too. You know, other posts and blogs and what have you don't really have, you know, the traditional spelling and the punctuation. And I'm wondering, you know, are we evolving past that? Do you see language kind of changing now that we're in the 21st century? You know, is there a need for, you know, making sure that non-restrictive clauses either have commas or don't? I mean, do you see like we're going to kind of, you know, I mean, language is mutable. Do you think we'll kind of get past, you know, some of this pedantic grammar that we think is so important? I still think it's important, but, you know, are we going to evolve to something a little more different? You know?
I really like the idea of this because I think that grammar has and always will be used for meaning. And if you have a sentence or a paragraph or a novel or whatever that doesn't make sense without the grammar, then yeah, the grammar is important. But I think if you look at the way that people are communicating online, the way that they communicate meaning is so different now. There's a lot more emphasis on fonts. There's a lot more emphasis on, you know, they'll put intents in brackets, so yes, and then in brackets, sarcastic intent. And I think that it's changing and has changed even in the last 10, 15 years when I've been, you know, primarily on the internet. But I think that grammar and writing and language has always been about communication and communicating effectively. And do we need to hang on to some of the grammatical things that we love so much, like the Oxford comma, if it doesn't help meaning anymore? But I also think that there will be, for a significant amount of time to come, a time for using correct grammar. You're going to need to use correct grammar in certain situations and in certain documents, in certain communications official or more formal writing.
Like code shifting, basically. Yeah. I wonder about emojis. You know, they seem to, I mean, you know, I've certainly adopted them. I mean, to me, we're just kind of going back to hieroglyphics. But the idea where they really depend on these little pictures to kind of add oomph to their meaning and to their writing. I had them do kind of the seniors do a kind of a freewheeling personal review of their high school experience. And I said, you know, you can be very creative with fonts and colors. And they're like, can we use emojis? And I'm like, yeah, absolutely. And so, and how much more that helped aided their, you know, communication skills, just kind of like by throwing down, you know, kind of the drunk face emoji or what have you. So I don't know. I think we're kind of in a brave new world. And it'd be fun to see how the language kind of keeps up. And will we get rid of who and whom finally? Because I don't think anyone's understood how to use who and whom properly since 1957. That's just my own personal opinion there. Let's go to Reason where we met over a year ago. Were you a judge right off, or did you start kind of writing your stories and then apply for the position?
No, I was a judge fairly quickly, I think. I don't know how many stories I'd written. I think it was only a scant handful. But yeah, no, I did get into judging quite quickly just because I wanted a way to, I don't know, involve myself with the community a little bit more.
And it's a great community. I mean, I've met some just amazing people all over the world. And how, you know, at that time you were probably reading, oh my gosh, you probably had about, what, 40 or 50 stories to read a week?
I mean, I think when I started judging, it was about 25, 30. And I thought, this is a lot, but it's manageable. And then as the numbers grew and really grew in popularity, yeah, the numbers of stories that you had to read was quite insane.
Yeah, I think the pandemic turned everybody into a writer. And that's probably the best free therapy for people to get through. Now with the change there of change, and it had to change, you know, it was unsustainable the way it was with, you know, thousands of entries a week. Do you see, you know, you still judge, yes. Mm-hmm. And do you see a change in the quality or the people with it being kind of more of a monetary, you know, kind of buy-in to compete versus just the free will? Do you see any kind of major changes, or is the quality better? Is it about the same?
I see a lot fewer. There were quite a few submissions that were put in because people had a personal rant that they wanted to get off their chest, or they'd written a cute story about their best friend, or they were an English learner from abroad who was practicing their skills. I see a lot fewer of those. But honestly, I've only judged a few times since the, monetary threshold was introduced, because I just don't have any time anymore. So I've knocked my hours down, I guess, so that I'm only judging every 6 weeks. So I've only been judged once or twice.
Right. It's, I think they're trying to like bring up some of the talent that normally wouldn't get heard or seen. But I just kind of wondered, you know, what the change was from your end. I think, you know, as teachers, you know, both you and I, you know, kind of understand the problem of being an English teacher is that you can read this one paper three times and have three different grades. You know, it kind of just depends on your kind of subjective mood, kind of what, you know, how it kind of hits you. And, you know, and I just think that, you know, writing contests, you know, they're fun and everything, but like anything else in the artistic realm, it's really, really subjective and, you know, what people like. And I know that you're kind of drawn towards writing that has this gorgeous description, probably because you're really good at it. I went back to look at some of your pieces there, and you love, I mean, you know, you could write ads for, like, you know, the catalogs. I mean, you do a really good job at visualizing a scene. And you like the twists and the kind of, you know, the kind of magical realm. Did you know you were like a sci-fi writer before you kind of started writing these short stories? Was that kind of was a genre that appealed to you?
Not even slightly. I think that the first couple of stories I wrote were dramas, I think, or just they didn't have a genre at all. They were just random ideas collected from the darkest corners of my mind. And although that makes them sound dark, they weren't. But I think that I always expected that if I became a writer, I would be a fantasy writer, because that's the genre that I enjoy reading. So I've got a lot of experience reading lots of really complex magical systems, and, you know, the cost of magic is X, Y, and Z, etc. And I started to try and write a fantasy novel over Mad Leave last year. And it turns out that I just don't have the imagination or the technical know-how to design a magic system from scratch. because I started thinking, oh, well, I'm going to do X, Y, and Z, but what if this? And then what if this? And then it didn't make sense. So sci-fi is easier to work with. You get all the fun of fantasy with none of the having to think up the reason, because you can just point and go, well, science.
Yeah, they call it science fiction and literature of ideas. You still have to have that amazing creativity. But again, world creation, like, it's kind of complicated. That's for people who have like their spices alphabetized in their kitchen, that type of thing. I'm more of the kinetic, something's got to happen like every sentence. I got to have this kind of bizarre characterization where you're like, you know, these people, but something's got to happen. I have to have a person, you know, walking, throwing a baseball, a crumb flying from the table. So I'm kind of drawn to those stories that are just moving, you know, moving, moving, moving. So, you know, again, to each his own with writing, it's kind of hard to teach writing when everyone kind of has their own individual style. And looking back at your style, yeah, the first few stories that you wrote there were pretty much these kind of warm family homecomings. You know, it's interesting. That's kind of where we start. I looked at mine as well. Mine were kind of kooky family homecomings, but I just got interesting the parallels, because I hadn't written, you know, for decades. You know, you get into kid world and raising babies and work, you kind of get lost there. I think, you know, when Laura is, about 10, 20 years into this baby Eliza phase, you'll have time to like map out with the yarn and the string, your fantasy worlds. But then, you know, you take kind of a shift there with this. You have the lovely 2 minutes and the lifetime they take. That's one of my favorite of your stories at the end there. I don't know if you've reread your stuff recently, but do one of the stories kind of stay with you? I mean, I love the World War One letters too. A letter to my son was lovely as well. But do you remember like one of the stories you kind of put down in the past year that you just really would like to go back and revisit the characters and the setting?
I always hear you asking that question about revisiting characters, and I don't think I've ever had a character that I've become particularly attached to. The characters that I put on page just are for that moment for me. And I don't think I've ever really connected with my characters in a way that you do. But then you write characters extremely well, and you have very in-depth thought processes for each one of your characters, and each one of your characters is very distinct. Whereas I think one of the things that I really struggle with and have tried to improve on over time is making my characters distinct personalities. Whereas I'm much more likely to become attached to a world because the description is a thing that really interests me. So I had a story that was a scientist who was supposed to be scouting a foreign world or a new dimension for resources, and she decided that she was going to stay over there and protect it from the company who was trying to take all of the resources from it. And that world has stuck with me a lot more than the character in the story did.
Was that Fall from Grace?
No. Fall from Grace was the one where she fell off a hospital called Grace Hospital, which was not my finest naming hour.
It was a good pun.
I mean, it's not the kind of story that has a good payoff for the pun.
Well, it was grimly funny. I'll plunge should be kind of painful on some level. Yeah. So, well, I mean, as your motherhood journey kind of continues here, you do find some time to yourself. You know, do you have a plan for a longer work, like a longer novel?
Well, I started writing last week, actually. I've had a bit of a break from it because just being a mother, being a teacher.
Yeah, life gets in the way for sure.
And you kind of have an hour free in the evenings, and you have to choose that, you know, what you're going to do with that hour. And half the time it is just staring into space and waiting for bedtime. But I started to write again last week because I've been listening to this podcast and it's just really inspired me to start writing again. And I sat down to write a short story for Readsy and accidentally wrote what I think could be the first chapter of a novel. Wonderful. Which I don't know if I'll ever have the time or the space to develop it, but it was... I kind of got to the end of the piece of writing and I was like, there is absolutely no way that I can finish this within the word count. There's just, I would need like 17 different plot points to be able to resolve where this story is going. And I just don't have the...
So when you conjure up this character, when it came to you, I mean, so do you find yourself writing in like long spurts? Because one of our authors that we talked to, Russell, wrote like, you know, just in increments, you know, and I'm more of like a sit down and pop out like, you know, 15 pages. You know, when the muses come to visit, you know, it's like vacant. And then like, they just show up and go, come on, let's go. And so do you write in kind of like little bits, or do you just kind of sit down and like, let it come out?
No, I prefer to write it. I think we're quite similar in that. I think I sit down and I go, okay, an hour and a half done. That's a story. Not that that's a fully fledged story, which is why when I was regularly putting it on Readsy, I would try and get it out onto Readsy within the kind of Monday, Tuesday for the Friday deadline, because I had a couple of people that regularly read my work and would edit it for me. So I could go, yes, well, if I put it out on Monday, then it's got time to iron out any of the kinks before Friday's deadline comes around.
That's a big key is getting away from it and then going back and going, this was awful, or this was fantastic. Yeah. I'm almost kind of surprised to go back and visit it, and I'm usually 100% wrong. Like when I nail it, I'm like, no, that was terrible. You know, it's perspective is very useful there. So now, when you were a little girl, a child growing up, did you like what books and what authors were you attached to? I assume you were, you know, like the rest of us, kind of introverts, kind of hide in the corner with a stack of books, or you know. Yeah. Was that you, or were you out there like, you know, with a stick being a snake and running around?
No, I was very much sit inside and read. I think my parents read me books all of the time, and my dad was amazing at creating worlds of his own for bedtime stories. Like, there was a whole Lauren there and Henry the Silver Dragon saga that used to go on for years. He actually told me the plot line of Gulliver's Travels for, I think, 18 years. I truly, genuinely believed that he had come up with that himself, and that was his own world. And then I got to university and studied Jonathan Swift, and I was like, Dad, you lied!
That's our job, parents. That's our job. It's just a lie. Gulliver's Travels is still so relevant today, you know, especially chapter 3. I think, you know, people see like Lilliput and they're like, yeah, that's great. And Rob McNagg and like, okay, that's great too. But I mean, where the bitter satire is chapter 3, because we're in this kind of post Age of Enlightenment, and we're definitely with the Houyhnhnms, where the horses are making a lot more sense than certainly most of the U.S. politicians. But I think Swift just, you know, he made the point there that as long as you can make people laugh because you're kidding, that you can kind of speak truth to power. And, you know, since we're in kind of a post satirical world, man, we need a whole bunch of Jonathan Swift kind of pointing out the chicanery and nonsense that is currently in power across the globe. That's just my own political stance there. You can delete that for Russell if you want to. So as you got into high school, did you have like an English teacher that inspired you to go study English? Or had you always wanted to be a teacher? Because, you know, what's wrong with you? Usually it's like an accident. Usually like it's a, you know, kind of a failed life effort. You end up teaching and no, I'm just kidding. But had you always wanted to be a teacher, or you, you know, what got you on that train?
Very much since I was a little girl, like I was fully on the teach train. I spent maybe 4 years over my university years and beyond going, actually, maybe I want to do publishing. Maybe I want to do something else to do with my English degree. And I quickly realized that there's not much you can do with an English degree that actually pays you money. So I went and I traveled for a bit and I taught English abroad and really enjoyed it. And I kind of taught English as a way to travel and loved teaching. So I came back to England to do my actual teaching qualification rather than the 10-minute thing I found on the internet. And teaching's a really challenging career, and it's definitely something that takes up your entire life. You don't get to be a part-time teacher even when you're on part-time hours. I mean, I taught part-time last year. I worked my solid amount of time each week. But it's so rewarding. It's just the best job in the world. Also the worst job in the world. But
you guess, exactly. I think for me personally, the idea to show that, you know, this rising generation, that everything that they feel and everything that they are concerned about have been thoughts and concerns for thousands of years. And to show them, you know, Oedipus Rex, and to show them Hamlet, and to show them just, you know, the same people, you know, hand-wringing what they do over family and girlfriends and lovers and just, you know, feeling frustrated with life and trying to find meaning, that these are, you know, all part of the human condition. And and they are reassured that they're not just the weirdo and they're doing things wrong, but that, you know, in books and when writers share, and artfully so, their human experience, having that connection and seeing their eyes light up and having them feel like they're home, you know, like, oh my gosh, you know, yes, you know, it's not just me. is just, it's just the best feeling. Of course, when they hate Hamlet, you know, it just breaks my heart. And they do about act four. So, but we're bringing back around when everyone dies in act five. Russell, do you have any questions for our beautiful Laura Clark?
I do, actually. I've had one. This is a really specific one about a specific story that you referred to earlier, which is Fall from Grace, which is a shortlisted story on Reedsy, of course. And the opening line, I just thought it was brilliant, and I'll read it for those that haven't read the story. But as Risha plummeted to her death, a wordless streak filled her mind. Oh, my God, I was just drawn in straight away. I instantly had to know a couple of things. One, how she was falling to her death in the first place. And secondly, how the hell was this story going to progress from here? So as a writer, just give us some insights into how you come up with this. Is it just a random flash of brilliance, or is it pondered for hours? I mean, just take us through that particular instance of how you come up with that great line.
Absolutely nothing is pondered for hours. I always used to look at the prompt on a Friday, and then I would not write anything until at least a Sunday, because it would just be ticking around in the back of my mind. But I read the Reedsy blog, and that one of the posts on there was about first lines, and it was one of the, I don't know if it was a judge or somebody who just writes the blog, but they were involved in the publishing world and the editing world, and they went through different first lines and they critiqued them. And I never sit and think with that in mind, but if there's an opening line that I think, oh, I'm not sure about this, I'll then go back to that blog post and go, ah, that's why this is not a particularly strong first line. And some of the things from that stuck with me, and it's things like, you know, you need some action, you need the character's name, those kind of things to draw people in. But no, I can't say that I sat and thought about that particular line for hours. I was quite pleased with it, though.
I thought it was brilliant. As I said, it got at me on two fronts. One, why was she falling to her death in the first place? But secondly, you know, how the hell is she going to go from it? Like, literally, the person's going to die. Okay, I won't do a spoiler for those that haven't read it. I recommend people go and read it. But anyway, I actually read it to my wife as I read it. I said, look, get a load of this first line. It's just awesome. But anyway, I just, like, how does one come up with that stuff? I just, you know, in awe of that. So anyway, that was my question. Deidre.
All right. Well, we'll let Miss Harashuka get back to her lovely family. Always a pleasure. We'll catch you on the Reedsy boards, Laura, and look forward to reading your next work.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right.
Thanks, Laura, for coming in and having a chat. In our next segment, Deidre draws from her mountain of writing tips and provides a little pebble that you may find useful in your writing. In this episode, she's going to be talking about sentence construction.
Thanks, Russell. Listen, Russell, if you want your reader to enjoy your writing, you got to help them through it. You got to take them by their hand and just kind of lead them elegantly through all of your verbiage. So you have to think about writing each sentence like you're just artfully constructing it very cleanly, very elegantly, because your readers want to read it very quickly. They want to absorb it without having to stop and reread stuff. So, I mean, good readers, we don't read word by word. We pick up big chunks and sections. We pick up phrases and clauses. And that's why, of course, punctuation is so important. But for the most part, if you throw in too much punctuation in the wrong intervals, you're going to just slow down your reader, and it makes it very awkward. So with that in mind, construct your sentences very thoughtfully and pay attention to what you're doing. So let's talk about misplaced modifiers, which can be unintentionally hilarious. So modifiers are phrases or groups of words that kind of describe elements in your sentence. And you got to make sure they are where they're supposed to be. For example, here's a sentence with a misplaced modifier. He served steak to the men on paper plates. Now, we know that the men are not on the paper plates. We know that. But just kind of like where it is kind of throws us off. You just need to kind of, you know, restructure it a bit where it's actually very clear. He served the men steak on paper plates. Yeah. Okay. So you have to kind of go back and make sure that all the phrases and clauses are kind of modifying or in the right spot for each sentence. Otherwise, there can be confusion and it just kind of, you know, it doesn't really flow. And that's what you want. You want this kind of fluidity so your reader can kind of get through your writing and pick it up as much as possible. So be aware of what you're doing. So here's another example. Many dogs are injured by cars and trucks roaming unleashed. Well, you know, the cars and trucks are not roaming unleashed. We have to move that whole phrase up to where it belongs, where many dogs roaming unleashed are injured by cars and trucks. So just pay attention of where, you know, certain phrases and groups of words go so you have the utmost clarity for your reader. Finally, Russell, let's talk about dangling modifiers at the beginning of sentences, the ones that don't really connect sensibly with the rest of the sentence. For example, passing the building, the vandalism became visible. You're missing the subject. We kind of have to add something in there to kind of make it clear. As we passed the building, the vandalism became visible. You have to make sure that everything that's being modified is just clearly thought out and not just kind of tacked on for readers to try and figure out as they kind of go through your writing. So again, Russell, if we want our readers to enjoy our writing, we got to help them through it. We have to make sure that they're constructed very cleanly, very elegantly, and make sure our modifiers are doing the job of modifying the noun or the group of words right next to it. All right, that sounds great. We'll see you next time.
Sadly, that's all we have time for on this episode. We would again like to thank Laura Harris-Shuka for coming on our podcast and providing some insights into her writing. Coming up in the next episode, we're going to be talking with Heather McQuaid, another great short story writer over at Readsy Prompts. So looking forward to that. Also coming up next episode, Deidre will be reaching into her writing tips jar for another nugget of wisdom about how to improve your writing. Before we go, I'd just like to mention, if you'd like to provide us feedback or come on and have a chat, we'd love to hear from you. You can get in touch with us at our website, readlotswritelots.com. Well, that's it for this episode. So on behalf of Deidre and myself and the entire team here at Read Lots, Write Lots, till next time, thanks for listening and bye for now.